Ukraine.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay, it's fine. Second point. I'll start. Hello, everybody. We are recording. Fine. Karina Vogelis, welcome. Alessia will take care of the presentation. You can share the session, Alessia.
Okay. Welcome Karina Vogel at this cafe club. She has done her PhD at TISO Garching under the supervision of Michael Hilkler and Thomas Burkert. Then she moved at the Utah University for a postdoc there, and now she is a Kness Fellow at the University of Strasbourg. Today she is going to tell us about the million of merged galaxy and their hidden supermassive black holes. So you can take it from here, Karina.
Thank you. Is my sound good?
Perfect.
Yes. Okay, because sometimes I have these earphones that with cordless, and in Big Blue Button, it didn't work very well last few times, so I just want to make sure. So yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for asking me. And yeah, I hope to tell you guys today why surviving nuclei of larger galaxy are out there and we should go find them. And if that's the only thing you take from it, I'm already happy, because it's like an up and coming field that, I think we should all learn a bit more about. So when I talk about nuclear star cluster, what do I mean? It's the center of galaxies. Most of us have heard of it. And in this plot, you can see this is just stellar mass against a fraction of galaxies with such a nuclear star cluster. And most galaxies between like 10 to 8 and 10 to 10 solar masses do have such a nuclear star cluster at the very high mass and low mass, and less galaxies do have one of these, but typically on average most galaxies do have one, especially those that get accreted on other galaxies. A 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 satellite galaxy will typically, 80% of them will have one of these central star clusters. So What do I mean when I talk about a star cluster? For example, in our Milky Way, we also have one. It has 3 × 10⁷ solar masses, and it has a black hole in it. So most centers of galaxies do have a black hole. And this black hole is 10⁶ solar masses. There's lots of data on this because you can, that's one that got the Nobel Prize, because you can actually see how the individual stars go around the black hole. And importantly, the relative fraction of the black hole mass to the nuclear star cluster is 13%. So when you have a nuclear star cluster in the center of a galaxy and you also have a black hole, then if you would take away the galaxy, that black hole makes up a lot of mass of this star cluster. And typically, if we look at a star cluster, just a normal one, they do not have massive black holes, and especially not massive black holes that make up 15% or 10% of their total mass. Because if they're not at the center of galaxies, they only have the stellar mass black holes, and you could imagine maybe 1,000, 10,000 solar mass black holes made from these stellar mass black holes, but nothing of a million solar masses. So in theory, that's how you can distinguish those two things. Of course, that's usually not necessary, because nuclear star clusters are at the center of galaxies. However, we know, that's the other thing, we know that galaxies, they merge and get accreted. This is Centaurus A, and when you zoom out in the halo, this is from the Pisces collaboration that I work with, you can see all these streams and tails. That's just all these short-lived signatures of this accretion. So what happens if you accrete a galaxy? Yes, it starts. Onto a bigger galaxy, it gets stripped. All the stellar stuff outside, in the outskirts of the galaxy, gets into tails like this. And what happens, what we see from simulation, is that the very, very center, this one, you can see after a few more orbits, it doesn't get destroyed. So a nuclear star cluster is really, really dense. You pack like 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar masses in like 20 parsecs. So it's among the objects in the universe with the highest stellar density that exists. And you can see up after all this merging, it didn't get destroyed, because there's no way to destroy something so dense with just the tidal forces of accretion. So we see this in simulations, actually. Down here is galaxy mass, and here is the black hole mass. Oh, sorry, this is the label. And when you typically, your halos are on this correlation line. So it's basically the galaxy black hole relation. Then you've seen simulations where galaxy gets stripped, that you move to the left. You have overmassive black holes. That's exactly what I just showed with, if you just have the single star cluster. You basically, you remove the stellar mass of the galaxy, but the black hole mass doesn't change, and the star cluster mass neither. So in theory, if you have galaxies that get accreted, you should still have these supermassive black holes because they don't go away from the centers. And thus, we should find overmassive black holes in remnants of this tidal stripping process, in theory. So how would that look like in a halo? This is just a sketch, like this is the Sombrero galaxy. You would have star clusters in a halo. And some of these wouldn't be actual star clusters like we know them, just globular clusters, but they would be the surviving nuclear star clusters of such an accretion process that happened a while ago. But as I just showed, on the first glance, they look really similar once they're not in the center of galaxies anymore. But on the second glance, you can look inside of them and try to see, is there a big black hole to distinguish them? So why do we even try this? I think that's an important point I have to make with people who don't work on this, because you're like, okay, cool, these things exist, but why should I care? So the first thing why it's relevant or interesting, we think, is that there is a correlation between the nuclear mass and the galaxy mass that it used to be in. So it's parent galaxy. So if I know, like, this galaxy has 10 nuclear star clusters that used to be in other galaxies, I can make a plot of accreted galaxy masses. So you can basically trace the accretion history of a galaxy beyond just using the streams, for example. Those live much less. Those dissolve within a giga-year or two, but these nuclear star clusters, they keep living. They don't get destroyed. The second point is these objects host supermassive black holes. And we haven't really looked for them because most supermassive black hole survey, they find black holes by accretion signatures, but old nuclear star clusters, they're old. They don't have gas anymore. So on average, there's not much accretion left. So you basically, with accretion AGN searches, you're blind to these supermassive black holes. So when we will know, when we will know how many of these objects are and how many host black holes, there's first estimates that this will increase a lot the amount of supermassive black holes in galaxies in general, because they could also be outside of the center of galaxies. And on top of that, if you know how many supermassive black holes there are, you will also increase, if you increase the amount of black holes, you will increase merger rates, like for gravitational wave events, supermassive black hole mergers, and also tidal disruption events when stars get destroyed when you get close to a black hole. All of these things will increase, and with LISA and everything coming up, this is important constraints you have to give them. So how do we try to find them? So all I've shown you guys is like the theory. So why is this so difficult? I just already mentioned a little bit. There is no real radio X-rays in most of these objects, at least not so bright that you can be sure that it's a galaxy, that it's a black hole. So we need to resolve the sphere of influence dynamically. The sphere of influence is the very, very, very center of the object, usually like a couple of parsecs, not kiloparsecs, but parsecs. And when I talk about these objects that we target to look for surviving nuclei, they are in the outskirts. So here you have a galaxy and they're like here. Or here, 14, 10 kiloparsecs. So they're really out there. And what I then have to do is, this is like an arc second and a half. And I have to basically go inside there and see, is there dynamical signatures of this black hole? How exactly do we do this? So you have to resolve that sphere. And first you need a high resolution imaging, usually from Hubble, but in the future Euclid and the Roman Space Telescope will help us with this. And then you have kinematic data. So this is key. The kinematic data must be resolved in 2D. So integral field spectroscopy, where you have every single pixel. So every single like differently colored thing here is basically a spectrum. And this is one of these objects for which we studied this. And you basically check whether there is a rise in the very center. Like in that, when you look at the data from the Milky Way black hole, when you see the stars moving faster, this is exactly what happens also in these objects, but it happens, we can only look at it in integrated light. So for example, here in the red, you see in the very, very central 0.05 arcsecond, the velocity rises sharply. And this is what we're basically looking for, but it's a really hard measurement because you need full adaptive optics and those 2D integral field units. And then we have this data, and then we need to model whether there's a black hole or not. So here is just a 1D data from such an object. So you see this rise in 1D, it goes up, whereas without black hole, it would be flat. But you have to carefully model that because it depends on the underlying stellar population and all of this. So in 2014, so the Anil Seth, who's at Utah, with whom I did my postdoc, he went out to try and do this. So until then, all of this was theory, what I showed, that in theory we should have nuclear star clusters, but people weren't like, I don't know, it's not even not convinced, but we hadn't found them yet. So if you haven't found it yet, people will always doubt that they really exist. So we looked at M60, it's a galaxy, and in particular M60 UCD1, it's called the object. It's a very dense 10 to the 8 solar mass object, and we took data with Gemini, with NIFs on Gemini, and what we found is this very, very sharp increase to like 100 kilometers a second in the very center. And if you model this, you find that this is the signature of a 10 to the 7 solar mass black hole. So this was actually published in Nature because it was the first discovery of something. And even more interestingly, it was the first discovery of something where the black hole makes up 15% of the total mass of this object. It is such a severe outlier to the usual black hole galaxy relations that it's very far. A typical galaxy has just 0.5% of its mass in the black hole. So due to this large mass ratio, we know that you cannot form 15% of your object's mass into black holes just due to stellar processes. People have tried and it's not possible. So this was the first confirmation that this thing exists, and it was really exciting. We were really hopeful. And once you have data like this, you can also infer the mass of the progenitor. In this case, it should be 10 to the 10 solar masses. So then you can make estimates. Oh, M60 must have merged back in the day with a 10 to the 10 solar mass galaxy, which I think is really exciting. So then over the last, while I was in Utah, we found 4 more of these objects. So it's a really tough measurement, and you need to have bright objects where you can do the AO and all of this. So we found 4 more. So in total, we have 5 now, which is it's a tough business because it's really hard to measure. So currently, I'm working on the 6th, and this is such an exciting object. I want to show you guys the deed. It's about to be submitted. So this is NGC 7727. What's so special about it? It's some post-merger signatures. And when you zoom in into this very center, you see the main galaxy. And a second very bright thing, which looks like it could be a second nucleus because it's so big. It's like 10 to the 8 solar masses. A typical star cluster doesn't get that massive, but the centers of galaxies do. So when you look at this in AGST imaging and color, you can see that something weird is going on. The red zones, that's all dust. But here, this object, it's completely different. It is much, much younger. It's like an average stellar age of a giga year, 1.5 giga years. And it is so blue in color, like it has nothing to do with the stellar population of the general galaxy. So there was a lot of, when this paper came out in 2018, there was a lot of talk about, there was some other evidence, but there was a talk about this could be a second nucleus that has just been formed. Like the galaxy, you still see the signatures because the ones I showed you guys here, there's no more tidal accretion signatures. So the hypothesis was this is an object in formation, where we see that nucleus. And even cooler than this, so this is my MUSE data that I got on it. MUSE is an integral field spectrograph where you have the kinematic information of every one of your pixels. And this object is so cool because the distance between both nuclei is only 500 parsecs. When you go back to the ones I showed you guys, this distance usually is like 10 kiloparsecs. So it's far out in the halo. This guy is much, 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 much closer. And the velocities of both nuclei in the original paper, we saw that they were very close. So if you modeled the potential merging timescale, it's below a giga year. So it's basically a merging system with two nuclei. And my job now was like, we need to find out whether it's really nuclei by measuring that black hole in the center. So what I got was those MUSE data. It typically looks like this. This is an integrated spectrum of nucleus one, just to show you guys how that looks typically. And you can even get the emission lines, because objects like this, still this object, because it's so young, has still some gas left because of that merger. So you can also model the emission line, and then you get basically the kinematic view of every single. So this isn't the image we took, it's the integral field data we have. So every single pixel here is a spectrum. So that allows us to really go in the center, because so MUSE has now a narrow field mode where you get full adaptive optics. And I didn't plot it here, but basically the sphere of influence of those two potential black holes is like 10 parsecs. So I needed a resolution, a spatial resolution, better of 0.1 arcseconds. So when you think of what you usually get with your standard imaging observation, seeing limited, in a good case, it's like 0.6. So when you zoom in to that kinematic data of both nuclei, you get something like this. So this is the center of the big nucleus. So this is my data. It's a bit noisy, but it is very well constrained. And that's the model of a 1 × 10⁸ solar mass black hole. And a model without black hole actually looks like this. So this is the velocity dispersion and the velocity taken together. So this isn't like an image, it's basically saying that, oh, over here in the center, it rises to 220 kilometers a second of dispersion, whereas in the outskirts here in the blue areas, it's like 170. And without it, because the stellar density goes down of the bulge, it would actually drop. So that was great. First black hole found, 35 sigma result. You cannot make this rise without a black hole. And then we looked at the second object, which has much, it's fainter. So the second object being this guy, our like offset nucleus. And same thing happened. This is our data and this is our model. And this is a 1 × 10⁷ black hole. And if you model it without black hole, again, it doesn't work. That very, very center is what you need. And here I illustrated that sphere of influence. So if you look at the X and Y, the whole X and Y axis is 1 arcsecond. So this is kind of the stunning thing about something like MUSE, like every single pixel is 0.025 arcseconds. And with the full AO, you get a resolution that I have 25 pixels or something within that sphere of influence. Back in the day before MUSE, there was nothing like it. Even that data I showed before, the first one we published in Nature, there was like 3 or 4 pixels within that sphere of influence. So this has really made a leap forward of how to resolve that sphere. And most crucially, this in the future, because it's in such an advanced stage of merging, it will, so this is 10⁸ and this 10⁷, it will be a 1:10 mass ratio double black hole merger, because at some point it will merge. And this is so this is the first time that we have actually found such a black hole that's below a kiloparsecs and dynamically confirmed them. If you look at the AGN service where they find these dual black hole systems, they're like between 1 and 10 kiloparsecs. So this is much closer together, and it's the first time we have found anything like this, showing the potential of our method and how great that is. All of these black holes, I call them hidden black holes, they weren't detectable before this because they're kind of silent. These have some emission lines, but they're not strong enough to get picked up by the typical surveys that really focus on high accretion AGNs. So as I said before, these objects are outlined in the black hole sigma relation. What does that mean? So these relations, bulge black hole mass and sigma black hole mass, they look typically like this. And our main galaxy, the nucleus one, the center, it falls straight, like literally straight onto it. It has the black hole you expect it to have. And our object, that second nucleus, falls on a line where it makes up 6 to 7%, depending on how you calculate, of the total mass of the object. And those blue dots are basically the other strip nuclei that we have found. So those are some of the most significant outliers to this relation, which will help us a lot to understand how black holes form and how stripping processes act on this relation. Good. Any question up to here? This was how to find those and detect those. No? Okay. Oh, yeah. So that's just my summary of this object. I think I've said already, but if you've slept until here, so I'm not done yet. This was just how to find them. If you take anything from this, is that supermassive black holes exist outside the centers of galaxies, and so far they were hidden because we couldn't find them due to the lack of accretion, and now with dynamical detection we can. And in the future this will actually get even, you can do this much further out. This object is a 27 megaparsecs, but Harmony on the ELT will be an IFU, and I can do it with that one. I've made some prediction. I can resolve the sphere influence of such black holes down to 100 megaparsecs. So we will, this basically, this whole method has a bright future. Yeah. And this was just a sketch of these galaxies merging and the stage, basically the kiloparsec separation. And typically AGN searches find it in this stage, two galaxies still pretty far, or when it's really close and they're tidally bound. But in this stage, below a kiloparsec, it's kind of rare. So we are like the first dynamical detection of such a system. So at this stage, how much time do I have left? We have six direct dynamical confirmations of such surviving nuclear star clusters. And back when I was in Utah, the question was, how many in general, overall, not just single detections, but in a halo of a galaxy, would we expect? Just quantifying this for the first time. So what I did to try to quantify this, and because at some point in science, you have to go from, oh, we have a handful of objects, to like, what's the statistics of these objects? So I assumed that star clusters with a supermassive black hole, when they increase the velocity dispersion in that very center, it's very bright in that center, so the luminosity-weighted dispersion increases because you just, stars move faster. So overall, if you just measure one mass of the object, just integrated light, quick measurement, you would expect the mass to be higher than expected because that black hole basically adds mass. And I basically assumed that you could use this total mass to predict backwards which ones have a black hole. So this is just mass versus expected mass, and this is the magnitude, and colored are all those where we find black holes, and they're all above the line. They have more mass than you expect. So when you do this prediction, you can make a mixture model. It's not very, but you say there's a population of these strip nuclei at higher than expected masses. And then for the first time, you can make an occupation fraction. You can say at which magnitude of star clusters, because those nuclei tend to be bright, how many of these are black holes? And we find that it's kind of cool. At the highest, at the most bright ones, most massive ones, like 10 to the 7, 60% should be such nuclei, which is really incredible. And even at lower masses, so most standard star clusters have 10 to the 5 solar masses. There, you don't have that many nuclear star clusters. But if you go to higher masses, that fraction increases fast. And then, for the first time, we were able to put those two things together. We had a first occupation fraction among star clusters. And you can just use the observed star cluster luminosity function in galaxies and put them together and say, okay, how many are we missing? How many are out there that we haven't found yet? And my prediction back then was that, for example, in Fornax and Virgo alone, you expect 69 was our prediction, plus minus, of course, like 20. And when you do this for the whole local universe, as good as you can, correcting for incompleteness and stuff, you would expect a 10 to 30% increase of the total number of black holes. So that's, to us, that was really a significant result, because if you have 30% more black holes, you expect so many more black hole rate events. So that is tidal disruptions, those where the star gets close to black hole and disrupts. And most importantly, those people who search for tidal disruption events, they throw away everything that's not in the center of galaxy. But we've shown that just galaxy assembly. Galaxy accretion should cause some of these black holes to still be in the halos of galaxies. So those events need to also happen outside of galaxy centers. And on top of that, of course, gravitational wave detectors should find higher rates because all of these predictions of gravitational wave event rates, they just take into account the black hole in the center of galaxies. That's how we always calculate them. So in an optimistic prediction, because there's goes more into this with the mass ratios, we actually had someone on our paper to help us predict this, you could increase the event rate up to 50%. And with LIGO and LISA coming in, hopefully the next, well, LIGO is already there, but LISA until 2030, I think. This will be really relevant. So this is basically the theory of the impact these objects could have on black holes. But then there's also, of course, what I just showed with the elevated total masses. You want to not just have six objects, but you want to make this census of how many surviving nuclei are there on a more broad scale. And as I've shown the integral field data stuff, it's not possible simply. The instruments aren't advanced enough to do this for every single object in like Centaurus A, for example. So we use this total mass as a proxy to try to do the first census of such nuclei observationally in a single galaxy. So in this case, we do this in Centaurus A. So I've shown you this to begin with, that big like halo of Cent A with all these accretion signatures. In my last paper in 2020, we used Gaia to find candidates for surviving nuclei out in the halo. And so these are all candidates for star clusters. And then you do follow up on those spectroscopically to see, do they have more mass than expected? So Gaia helped us a lot with this, because what you have to know is this is like degrees on the sky. And if I would have to put a fiber on everything that could be a GC, I would have to do 500,000. Whereas now with Gaia, I have 600 targets, because Gaia helped us to see which things are extended. And then we find all of these guys that are obviously star clusters. And this made it really efficient. And the dynamical mass basically that we get from this follow-up will indicate which ones are nuclei. And of course, before my Gaia method, all the GCs known were like in a box of this size, 20 kiloparsecs. But things that were recently accreted, the tidal features, they're out here. So we expect lots of the nuclei being out there too. So our goal is to make this the first census basically of stripped nuclei around a single galaxy, and then to directly measure basically the past accretion history of galaxies that were nucleated. And this is ongoing, and hopefully we have the first results of the dynamical measurements already, but the candidate selection is already published. And we also, doing this candidate selection, we actually confirmed the 8 most distant GCs in Cent A. So it has a lot of cool side effects scientifically that weren't even the goal. So in the future, this also, the method that I use Gaia for, to find these candidates out in the halo, you can also use Euclid for this, because it will provide this high resolution imaging on 15,000 square degrees. So the star clusters will be resolved. Like, similar to Gaia, you can say, oh, this thing is a little extended, like a star cluster would be, an extragalactic one. And this will go far beyond the capabilities of Gaia, because Gaia only goes to like 20th magnitude, whereas Euclid will go much deeper. So currently our goal is to expand this Gaia method to find the nuclei to the entire local universe, or the local universe that Euclid is covering, using this using Euclid imaging when it comes online. And we're currently working on this with some people from Strasbourg. So here's my summary. So if you slept until now, it's okay. It happens to me sometimes too in online talks. If there's one thing I want you guys to take, is surviving nuclear star clusters exist, and they have overmassive black holes in their centers. And that's a thing that has been only established the last 6-7 years. And they also have a lot of scientific potential. The supermassive black holes in them were previously hidden and silent, and now we can find them. And they will increase black holes and the event rates associated with them. And in the future, we can make the observational, basically, census of this using Gaia, Euclid, plus spectroscopic follow-up. And hopefully then we will know much better how many actually exist and not just like a guess, basically based on small samples. So yeah, that's currently what I'm doing, and I'm happy. I hope I didn't go over time to take questions.
Thank you, Karina. Thanks a lot for the nice talk. Is there any questions? So I'll probably start if I take the possibility. So I have two questions. One is, with your kind of study, how far in the local universe can you go? So what's the most distant systems that you can trace?
With which method? So with my IFU spectroscopy, currently the limit is like 25 megaparsec, like Virgo cluster limit for the brightest objects. But with this type of method, it all depends basically. So it depends on two things, the apparent size of the GC and the magnitude limit of your survey. So with Gaia currently we're limited by its magnitude 20, where you can still say whether they extended. So there's different limitations, but I always call it the local universe. Our goal really is to understand this out at least a Fornax and Virgo cluster. And once Harmony comes online in Euclid, we can hopefully push it to like 1500 megaparsecs.
Okay, and the second question is, you said that counting the number of star clusters in a system, you can trace the accretion history of the entire system. So I was wondering, and this is connected with tidal fissures, right? So I was wondering, if you put together all the information that you have, so position with respect to the center of the main galaxy, the size of your star clusters, could you be able to trace substructure in light? So could you say, okay, I find the star cluster here. This is the distance, this is the size. So with the help of simulation, I can suggest that there will be a substructure in light. So can you use star clusters as traces of tidal features?
Yes. So when the accretion event happened more recently, you should be able to still see them aligned with the tidal features. For example, in the Panda survey in M31, I don't have the image, you see like lots of star clusters aligned with the tidal feature in the outskirts of M31. However, tidal features, the streams and stuff, are supposed to dissolve after a giga year or two. The cool thing about my nuclear star clusters is that they're long-lived. If they don't merge quickly, then they stay in the halo and they keep existing. So me saying we trace the assembly history is saying, oh, I have 8 nuclear star clusters or something in my halo, random number, and they have a certain mass, so I can make, because the nuclear star cluster mass correlates with the galaxy mass, and then I can say, oh, it must have accreted 8 galaxies of this and this mass. Whereas with tidal features, those are really nice to say, oh, accretion event happened, but they don't live as long. And after a certain time, like at the time where I look at my objects, usually the tails have already dissolved. So that's like the difference. But for example, in the object I've shown, this really cool new guy. Where is it? So there's actually a blue stream. You can see it in deep imaging, in which this guy is embedded. So in an object like this, which is information, where it happened recently, the merger was supposed to be a giga year or two ago in this object, NGC 7727. There it still aligns with a stream and a tidal feature. So it all depends on your timing, but what I'm saying is, instead of just being able to time this for giga, I can, as long as they still exist out there, I can find them.
Okay, thanks a lot. And then we have a question from Guillaume.
Yes, thank you very much for your very nice talk. I have a question. So do we expect a merger between two supermassive black holes with what you say? I mean, for gravitational waves, for example, is it
yes
possible?
That's exactly what LISA will find, right? The coalescence mass of LISA needs to be a bit smaller than 10 to the 8. I think that it can pick it up. But yes, so we expect binary supermassive. So that's like the formation, right? Once you get at subparsec scales, you make a binary, which is gravitationally bound. And at some at some point is supposed to coalesce and emit gravitational radiation. And we've seen that for stellar mass black holes with LIGO, but LISA will be the big test for supermassive black hole coalescence. Yeah.
And
what I'm saying in my paper or in my work here is just, if there's the predictions for event rates have been made, oh, there's a galaxy here, black hole, and you can make estimates how many galaxies are black holes, and then you estimate your event rate statistically. But in the local universe, at least, you also have these old stripped mm-hmm. black holes that are not in the center of galaxies anymore. And this is so far understudied, I would say.
But because I suppose that because the supermassive black holes are much more massive than standard black holes, they should be much more easy to detect from a gravitational wave point of view.
It's actually, I think I have a figure of this that I didn't show. Yeah, so I can't show it, but I can show it like this. So it's actually not true. So the higher the coalescence mass, the lower the frequency. So that's why they have to go do LISA in space, because you have to have, I don't know, 150 million kilometers or something of the length of the arms of LISA to detect this, because the frequency will be lower. So it's all a matter of how you can detect them. So it's not necessarily easier, but the frequency, because the masses are so high, is much lower. So where's LISA on this plot? So we currently have LISA is here basically mm-hmm. at 10 to the minus 2 of frequency, and LIGO is basically in this range.
Okay.
Where you basically have the binary like 20 solar mass black holes, and the coalescence mass that LISA will detect is like up to 10 to the 7. So the most massive ones, actually it can't detect 10 to the 8 10 to the 9 coalescence mass. Coalescence meaning the mass of both black holes is will be further over here. That one is 10 to the 9 solar mass binaries.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
So it's funny enough, it's not that simple, even if they're more massive.
Karina, can you comment about the ability of, well, I ask because I don't see any raised hand, of the James Webb integral field unit to perform to expand your...
Yeah, no, I didn't even apply for this because there's no AO, and the pixel size, I don't even know what it was, but 0.2 arcsecond or something. I need an order of magnitude more, like an AO. So JW2 has its a huge advantage for so many science cases, but for mine, sadly, it won't work. Harmony, however, that will be a game changer. In full AO, it will reach 0.05 arcseconds or even less, 0.03. So you can literally, in the object that I looked at, instead of resolving like the inner... here I can basically, where is it? I resolve the inner 10 parsec, I can literally look even deeper. It will be incredible. Like, so for me, all is the how much your adaptive optics spatially resolves and the size of your pixels. So harmony will be, with the ELT, it will be an order of magnitude better than mu in full AO. So that's all I'm looking forward to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karina. Any further question?
Yes, I have perhaps a very naive question, but if you have the coalescence of supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxies, how is it consistent with the relation between the mass of the supermassive black holes and the mass of the bulge or the dispersion of the stellar content? Because at the end, if you have a lot of events and the mass of the mass of the supermassive black hole will increase, and what about the stellar content? Perhaps a very naive question.
I understand your point. You're like, but it merges. So I'm not a theorist of this. You have to ask Marta Volontari, and she's at IAP in Paris, but I can give you the...
Perhaps do you put some constraints on the... Well, I don't know.
So actually, the way we will use this method to put constraints of black hole seed formation is actually interesting. So the first point is, if you add mass and you add black hole, so this is a log-log plot. So adding a bit, like, if these two guys merge, right, you add a 10 to the 7, you add a bit of black hole, but you won't go very far. Like you won't, and there's some scatter in this relation. There's some discussion where the scatter comes from, but it's a log-log plot. So even the coalescence of 1 to 10 will not completely set you off of this plot. And you also add stellar mass, right? So, but the real origin of this bulge black hole mass relation, it's still under debate. I cannot really, I should not really go too deep into this, but
yes, I understand. You have a lot of events, a lot of mergers. Of course, only one is not sufficient because, given the dispersion of the relation. But if you have several events during the life of the galaxy, I don't know, at the end, well, you could have some tensions with the relation or interpretation of the relation.
Yeah. So the way we try to use what we do for black hole theory is, so the black hole theories always differ at the low mass end. So whether dwarf galaxies have black holes or not is really important, because if the occupation fraction is really high, wait, which way around was it? So if the occupation fraction of black holes in low mass dwarf galaxies is high, then the seed, the formation by which they seeded must be different as if they're more rare. If they're more rare, then you have probably like the high mass seed just collapsing. But if they're very common, then you know they must have seeded from smaller seeds. So all of this is basically encoded in the lower mass galaxies. And the progenitor ones of mine, so they're typically a bulge mass of 10 to the 9, etc. So so the progenitors of my strip nuclei, they're not that massive. So by knowing how many there are, you can trace back like the amount of supermassive black holes in low mass galaxies. This is a very hot topic right now, because this is where really the high mass seed and the low mass seeds diverge. So we hope to be able to contribute a bit to this discussion, because you can trace back from which galaxy it should have come from. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's Thank what our aim is. But black hole merging and growth is a whole other field. But
Thank you.
Any further question for Karina? So if not, I'd like to thank Karina Gay. Very nice talk.
Thanks so much. I wish we could go and have some coffee now.
Later, maybe later in time. And maybe Carlo, you want to say something about the next Cafe Club?
Yeah, it's already scheduled. Thank you. Thank you, Karina. Thank you, Alessia.
Sure.
It's already scheduled. I don't remember. I'm going to check right now. The next one will be by Erwan Ellis, results from scattering transforms in astrophysics and cosmology, a speaker proposed by Ghislaine. And so see you next week.